My name is Dan Spencer, and this is the third in a series on lesbians and gay men in the church. Our focus today is titled The Church, Homophobia, and AIDS. The first two sessions have covered what it's like to grow up being gay and Christian, and also a very brief introduction at re-examining scripture and what it may and may not say about homosexuality. Today I'd like to address a topic that I think is of critical importance for both the church and the wider society, and that is the whole situation of homophobia that pervades our society, and related to that, heterosexism. And particularly then I'd like to focus on those two things and then look at the AIDS crisis that's confronting our society and see how homophobia, heterosexism affect the dynamics of responding to that, both within the society but especially within the church. And then finally look at some responses that the church might be able to make to that. Before I define some of the terms I've written up there, I'd like to just start with a couple short descriptions of some experiments that were conducted to see if people could test if there was an objective difference in the way people reacted to heterosexual people they presumed were heterosexual and people they presumed were homosexual. A man named Terry Levy at California School of Professional Psychology in San Diego designed designed part of her doctoral dissertation to focus on this question, and she prepared an experiment, and I'll simply read what she did here. She produced a videotape that purported to be a counseling session between a female client and her therapist, and the tape was then screened for an audience of more than 100 students preparing for professional work in therapy. Before the screening, all the students had been provided with a lengthy clinical history of the client who appeared on the tape. Half of these written histories advised the reader that the client was lesbian. The remaining subjects were led to believe that the client was heterosexual. All the other information provided in the histories was identical, so that it became reasonable to infer that differences in subjects' attitudes toward the client were functions of the lesbian label. And then she writes, the differences were not only statistically significant, but dramatic. For those subjects of the experiment who understood the client in the film to be lesbian, she was seen as more defensive, less nurturant, less affiliative, less autonomous, less self-confident, and overall less healthy than the same woman who appeared to subjects who saw her as heterosexual. So positive were the subjects' reactions to the heterosexually labeled client that many of the students professed puzzlement that she was even in therapy. A similar, a different kind of experiment, but one that was conducted to test similar kinds of things, was not only to see if people were devalued for being gay, but whether people would actively seek to avoid them. So it's a very simple experiment, but what they did was they put together an experiment where subjects participated in a laboratory game with an imaginary partner, someone they could not see, but they could talk to in an adjoining room. And this, and after they went through this experiment with a number of questions and so forth, they were given the choice whether or not they wanted to meet the partner when the experiment was over. In nearly all cases, when the person was described as being heterosexual, they chose to meet them and talk to them about the experiment. In most of the cases, when the person in the other room was described as homosexual, even though they were the same person, the vast majority of cases, people chose not to meet that person and talk to them. I use these as examples of the phenomenon of homophobia. And while homophobia is not a terribly precise word, meaning fear of the sameness, essentially, it's a word that has come to describe a lot of behaviors that are negative reactions to people or feelings of same-sex orientation. A more precise definition of homophobia would be the irrational fear of same-sex orientation or attraction. Irrational meaning it's not grounded, it's a fear that's not necessarily grounded in rational reasons, but is a strong fear that can affect our behavior and our reactions to either people or feelings of same-sex attraction. And one thing that's important to realize is that homophobia is something that's socialized into all of us. It's not something that's the exclusive property of heterosexual people or homosexual people or anyone in between. We all grow up in a society that is strongly homophobic. And we all, to some degree, internalize that and have that in turn shapes and be our behavior unless we recognize it and learn to deal with it. A related word or related situation would be heterosexism, which is a term other people are choosing to use instead of homophobia to, one, take the attention off of the sort of an individual response of an individual phobia that someone might have to homosexuals, and to also to show that it is an ism that pervades all of society. Heterosexism is simply the belief that heterosexuality is functionally and morally superior to other ways of being. And we point out that we live in a strongly heterosexist society where heterosexism is operative at all levels, at the individual level, at the institutional level, and in all structures that pervade our society. There is a bias that considers heterosexuality and heterosexual norms to be normative, to be superior to other modes of being. And many people have pointed out how this in particular has discriminated against women. Not only lesbians, but women in general, that the overriding assumption that heterosexuality and heterosexual marriage is the only norm, and particularly with the economic situation of women in our society, where they earn something like 60 cents per the dollar of a job that a man would have having the same job, that this has oftentimes forced women to comply to a mode of being because of this overriding heterosexual bias. But today I want to look at the effects that it has on homophobia and the way we respond to homosexuals or same-sex attraction. Are there any questions on those two definitions of homophobia or heterosexism? I think they'll be clearer as we go along, but if there aren't any, if it's not clear at all, let me stop now and clarify that. Again, I'm at this point not attaching any value to heterosexism. It can be argued that that's an important way to operate in society and that we ought to promote that. It's simply a descriptive term that says that there is a bias in this society in favor of heterosexual behavior and norms. I'll argue later I think it's destructive, but at this point it's a value-free term. There are many forms that homophobia takes, and as I read this off, see if you can identify within your own life situations where you think this may have been true for you. One is the fear, simply the fear of being thought of being thought homosexual by others, of other people thinking you might be homosexual. And some examples might be if you have family members or friends who are lesbian or gay and you want to read up about it, that first time you go into a bookstore and you think twice before you ask the clerk, where are the books that treat homosexuality? Or if you ever were reading one in the bookstore in the corner and someone walked by and you kind of shuffled it under another book. Any of those kind of responses have to do with the homophobia in our society that make it fearful to be labeled as someone who is homosexual. And so we form our behavior in response to that fear. Another example might be the fear of a possible homosexual response in oneself. We have a society and a church that has created a lot of fear about our own sexuality, and particularly about homosexuality. And this, in turn, has oftentimes engendered a lot of fear within people that whether they are consider themselves homosexual or not, that maybe there's a part of them that is. And this has then interfered with our relationships, our friendships with people of the same gender. Is it okay to hug another man, another woman? If so, how much distance do you keep between the bodies? All those kinds of things. If you've ever had those kind of questions going through your mind, that's another example of the fear that comes from homophobia. A very predominant one that we hear a lot is the fear of catching homosexuality. That somehow homosexuality is a contagious disease, that if we're around homosexual people, we might catch it. And this particularly comes up with the fear around children. That somehow children in particular are particularly vulnerable to catching homosexuality. Or a similar but related thing is the fear that if children see homosexuals, they'll somehow, they will choose that as their means of sexual expression. And therefore, to not give them that option, we need to shield them. That there's something very enticing about homosexuality, that if a child were given that choice, they would choose that. There seems to be a very real fear in that. Therefore, it's important, for example, to keep openly homosexual people out of schools. homophobia also affects lesbians and gay men in a number of different ways, and probably the most predominant, I hope people in the back can still hear me, I'll try yelling, but probably the most predominant is internalized feelings of inferiority and self-hatred. We grew up with so very, very few positive role models and so very many negative ones that it's difficult for us to grow up with a positive self-image as our feelings of homosexual orientation emerge. And so oftentimes the very first steps that a homosexual person needs to deal with is learning to have a positive self-image. Homophobia, as probably be clear from all these things, serves in a number of ways. It serves, for lesbians and gay men, it serves to keep us in our closets. There are fears at every level, and so it serves to keep us hidden, both from each other, but also from our families, our loved ones, our friends. For straight people, for heterosexual people, it, as I mentioned, affects a wide variety of relationships and dynamics, particularly same-sex friendships. And the whole fears that come along with that because we are afraid of homosexuality or possibly being labeled as homosexual. There are a number of responses that come from homophobia that we see typically in our society. One, I would label all those responses that come under what has been called the dangerous repressive, i.e., homosexuals are dangerous to society, therefore we need to repress them. Homosexual teachers are dangerous to our children, therefore we need to exclude them. Homosexual people are dangerous to have in the apartment house, therefore we will not let them live here. All of the reasoning that starts with the assumption that homosexuals are dangerous, therefore we somehow treat them differently and usually in a repressive manner than non-homosexual people. Related and oftentimes undergirding this is what's been described as moral reprobation. And that is the whole idea that homosexuals are sinful or immoral and therefore must be excluded from the church, from the country club, from the swimming club, all sorts of different things, starting from the assumption that they're either immoral or sinful. A third one that's related to homophobia and intertwined is the whole notion of stereotypes, and particularly the stereotypes that we grow up with about lesbians and gay men. Somehow all gay men have limp wrists and are effeminate, and all lesbians are really tough and masculine and aggressive and like to wear ride motorcycles and wear leather. As with any stereotype, there's some element of truth. There are lesbians who what we call masculine, and there are gay men who have behavior that we would call effeminate. But there are straight men and women who would fall in the same particular behavioral categories. And the stereotyping, again, serves as a homophobia or homophobic tool to keep people in their place because of fear. It's very, very frightening, for example, for a young boy who's going through adolescence who may or may not be homosexual. The majority of cases, probably not. But for whatever reasons, doesn't fit up to societal standards of masculinity, almost inevitably is labeled a fag or a queer. Similarly, girls who are tomboys and there's some don't fit into what our traditional cultural understanding of what it is to be feminine oftentimes are labeled dykes or lesbians. Again, stereotypes serve as a repressive tool to keep people in their place. There are a number of behaviors that are associated with homophobia, and some of them you can recognize in the illustrations I gave at the beginning. The first one I would label is simply distancing or avoiding. That whole exercise where people were given the option to meet the person after the experiment or not, and when they thought the person was heterosexual, almost always went and met them and talked about it. When they thought they were homosexual, they didn't. There's an avoidance going on there. There's a distancing. There's somehow a fear of that person or a loathing or repulsion, whatever, is causing people to avoid or distance them. And this is probably one of the most frightening things about coming out as a gay person, the fear that we have that our loved ones will reject us and distance themselves from us, and all too commonly that has been the pattern. A second type of behavior associated with homophobia is what has been called discounting or devaluation, i.e. once you know that person is gay or lesbian, you somehow discount or devalue what that person has to say or the input That'd be an example would have been the first exercise I read, where people saw the client as much less healthy, only on the assumption that that person was lesbian. The behavior was identical, but the people that thought that she was lesbian saw her as unhealthy, the people that thought she was straight saw her as healthy. They devalued that person based on their assumptions about her identity rather than the actual behavior. Another example might be that the talk I gave yesterday on the scriptures, it's oftentimes very difficult to be a gay person talking about those things because one of the first reactions against people who have homophobia, or all of us, is to say, well, of course, he's gay. That explains why he's saying that, he's gay. What is happening there is people are looking at the identity of the speaker rather than what the speaker is saying and using that as a means of devaluating or discounting what the person has to say. The flip side of that is if you know many straight people who speak about lesbian or gay issues, oftentimes one of the first things they will say is, well, while I'm not gay myself, I know that. And whether this subconsciously or not, what this does is address our homophobia, that if this person is somehow interested in this issue, he or she might be gay. Or, on the other hand, saying that since I'm not gay, this may give me some more credibility. I have tremendous admiration for straight people who don't identify themselves as straight when they're dealing with lesbian gay issues. It's a courageous step to take because people oftentimes make that identity for them, which is false. But more often than not, people will start off by saying, while I'm not gay, I think this. And I think that's one thing that homophobia begins to do to us. A third behavior associated with homophobia is the whole realm of scapegoating. That idea of blame the victim. Gay people are oppressed because they deserve to be. There's something about them that makes them, that they deserve that. Or this oftentimes comes about with the fourth one, which is aggression. Anti-gay violence is a behavior that oftentimes comes out of homophobia. But people oftentimes justify anti-gay violence because through a whole blame the victim mentality. And this has been very, very painful for lesbians and gay men who've been victims of anti-gay violence. When they go to the police station to report it, they're oftentimes derided. They're oftentimes say, you brought it on yourself. It's your fault. As you know, you were doing something that attracted attention to you, as if that justifies being attacked or being murdered in many cases. So that whole interplay between blaming the victim and then the violence that comes out of homophobia. Psychologists and sociologists who have studied the phenomenon of homophobia have identified a number of variables that seem to contribute to high levels of homophobia. And I'll just name a few of these. Probably one of the most important ones, people that are strongly homophobic are oftentimes people who have never knowingly met a homosexual person. They will claim, I don't know any homosexuals. I've never met a homosexual. And what they actually probably are describing is they've never met anybody who is openly homosexual. It'd be very difficult for any of us to go through our life without meeting someone who's homosexual. But at least they believe that they have never met a homosexual person. And this is a dynamic that's very common in many different kinds of oppression. If you've never met a black person, if you've never met, if you're not around elderly people, whatever, the more distance you have from those people, the more easily it is to discount them and to fuel prejudice against them. So people who have not ever knowingly met a homosexual person oftentimes are strongly homophobic in their response. They've also found that those who are either highly dogmatic or have a low tolerance for ambiguity are homophobic. And my experience, for example, within the fundamentalist communities in the church, and this is not to pick on them, simply to point out a dynamic that I have noticed. Oftentimes these are communities that are highly dogmatic and have a very low tolerance for ambiguity. They feel very threatened, for example, with an understanding of the Bible that allows any ambiguity in the Bible. It's either the Word of God, infallible, inerrant, or not. And that is not saying that's bad or good, but oftentimes with those communities comes a high level of homophobia and inability to deal with lesbians or gay men or same-sex feelings. Combined with this, the third variable involved in high levels of homophobia would be those who have a high stake in sex role rigidity. That is the whole thing of There are appropriate roles for men and appropriate roles for women, and we can't cross the lines. This is very much tied in with sexism and discrimination against women. But some examples would be in the working world. There are jobs that are set aside for men, and there are jobs that are set aside for women. And if you cross those lines, you're oftentimes considered suspect. So men who are nurses are oftentimes considered suspect for being gay men. Or women who are construction workers are oftentimes accused of being lesbians or dykes or whatever other term they want to throw at them. But there is a confusion between gender identity and sexual orientation. And somehow, if you cross one of them, that makes you suspect for having crossed the other. This shows up in a rigidity about personal habits between what's appropriate as masculine and what's appropriate for feminine. How many of us grew up with if you're a boy, you grew up with the maxim, boys don't cry. That i.e., if you're a man and you cry, there's something suspect around you. Or girls don't swear. It's not nice for girls to swear. So if you're a woman and you use coarse language, then maybe that makes you suspect. Another area would be the whole realm of social or domestic work division. Women attend to things in the house, men attend to things around the house. And if you're a man who likes to cook or a woman who likes to mow the lawn, there may be something wrong with you. Also associated with sex role rigidity is the whole notion that the man or the father is the head of the household and ultimately has this responsibility and the power in the household. What comes out of people that identify strongly with this is there's a real fear of sex role confusion. And again, it's tied in with, I think, of the fear of ambiguity. People that need to have very clear guidelines that are not crossed. And if they are, this raises incredible levels of hostility within them. And one of the interesting things about homophobia is that it's oftentimes easier for people to dismiss or to deal with gay people who fit the stereotypes. I.e., when they've done studies of men's reactions to gay men, whether the first case they'll have men's reactions to effeminate gay men, oftentimes that's not as threatening as men's reactions to masculine gay men, because men, straight men, oftentimes think that it's confusion between gender role, I should be masculine, and sexual orientation, I should be straight. And what is confusing there is here is someone that for all intents and purposes is masculine, and yet is not straight, who's homosexual. And this has raised incredible levels of hostility or fear among straight people because of the confusion that results. Those are some of the different dynamics that I would say are involved in homophobia. And I guess at this point I'd like to just see if there are questions or people have other input or things before we move on to the AIDS question, how homophobia affects how we deal with AIDS. Any input or questions or clarification or discussion?
No, yeah. I just have a thing. I have a friend who had a close relationship with a girl, and she, I mean, I don't think she's lesbian, but I mean, she was trying to find out herself, and her mom, and she never really met this girl, she just kind of started corresponding to her with mail, and they were going to meet this summer, and it never worked out because the other girl died in a car crash. But anyway, the mother was really suspect of my friend as being lesbian, because she would always talk to this girl, and then always had this special close relationship, and then it started scaring my friend, and she started, you know, and then she went to the library to try to check out a book, and it's the same thing that you said, that she was so embarrassed to be having the book, and that she went and hid it in her drawer and didn't want her mom to see it, you know, and she was kind of trying to tell her mom, well, mom, you know, so what if I am lesbian, would you love me anyway? And it was kind of a whole real tension around her for a while to even think that, oh, maybe I am, you know, how scary, what awful mm-hmm. thing to happen to me. So I could relate to what you're saying.
And again, I would point out that all of these dynamics that I've mentioned occur across the board in gay people and straight people both. They're all things I think we're all internalized because of the society we live in that teaches these kinds of values. And particularly within the church, it has often been one of the major institutions that has reinforced these kinds of responses. The whole question of AIDS, I think, throws this into relief, the question of homophobia and how we respond to the AIDS crisis. My premise is that homophobia in the church is blocking the church's response to AIDS. And I say this for a number of reasons. One, I know some people who are AIDS patients or people who have come down with AIDS, and just hearing how they have been treated by their churches, but also just a familiarity with the literature on this. It's very interesting to me that the church, the Christian church, is as part of its identity, claims to be a caring, compassionate community of grace and love. And yet most victims of AIDS experience the church as a community of judgment and condemnation. And I believe it's because homophobia is strongly blocking the church's pastoral ministries towards gay people and people who have AIDS. And this is in turn causing this dynamic. If you ask what's the point of intersection between AIDS and homophobia, it comes down as fear. Fear is where these two crises really meet, the one of situation of homophobia and the AIDS crisis. And James Nelson, who is an ethics professor at United Theological Seminary in Minneapolis, and some of you may be familiar with his book, Embodiment, but he has written an article on this where he looks at what he calls the ingredients of AIDS hysteria, the irrational response to AIDS. And he says part of it is that the AIDS crisis combines two fears that are very, very deep-seated within Western Christian society. One is the fear of sexuality, since AIDS is a sexually related disease, and we have a society that's very afraid of looking at sexuality. And the second is the fear of death, since AIDS, as far as we know, is nearly almost always terminal. The whole fear of death. And when you combine those two, that is a very, very potent combination right there. But the third ingredient in our society that makes it even more explosive is one of homophobia. Because within the United States, the primary group of people being devastated by AIDS are gay men and sexually active gay men. And while this is not the case in other communities around the world, for example, in Africa, it's predominantly heterosexual people who are coming down with AIDS. But within this country, it's primarily gay men, and so it has the AIDS disease has come to have a gay stigma attached to it, which again, another manifestation of homophobia. But when you combine the fear of sexuality, the fear of death, and homophobia, you have all the ingredients you need for what he calls AIDS hysteria, how we respond to AIDS. Well, part of the problem about AIDS is that while there has been a good deal of information out about AIDS, there's also a good deal of misinformation, and many people are just not familiar with what AIDS is. I want to call your attention to and encourage as many of you as are interested to pick up one of these afterwards, because the ALC, the American Lutheran Church Mission Discovery Program, has put together a very, very helpful report on AIDS called AIDS, A Challenge to the Church, which is educational. It tells about AIDS, what AIDS is, what AIDS is not. It dispels some of the myths, and also talks about ways the church can be involved in that. So I'd encourage you to pick some of that up. I've just recorded a couple of the definitions for us to have as working definitions, so we're talking about the same thing here. AIDS, according to this paper and other works I've read, is a serious condition that is characterized by a defect in your natural immunity system. AIDS means acquired immune deficiency syndrome. And what that means is all of us have a natural immune system within us that filters and destroys the vast majority of germs and viruses that we're exposed to. AIDS is simply a virus that causes a breakdown in that immune system, and so you become vulnerable to diseases that normally our natural bodies would, our natural immune systems would filter out. People who have AIDS are vulnerable to serious illnesses which would not be a threat to anyone whose immune system was functioning normally. And these illnesses are referred to as opportunistic illnesses or diseases. Then a couple things you may have heard before, but about 85% of all AIDS patients studied have one of two rare diseases. One is a pneumonia called pneumocystis carinii pneumonia, PCP, which is a parasitic infection of the lungs. And the second one is Kaposi's sarcoma, a type of cancer, very rare. And both of these types of illnesses were almost unheard of in the literature, medical literature, before AIDS came about, which made AIDS very difficult to diagnose at first because these were essentially almost unrecognized diseases. But they are ones that are particularly opportunistic. They take advantage of the breakdown in the immune system that the AIDS virus attacks. quite, and I won't go into a detailed explanation of how AIDS work, but essentially what happens is the AIDS virus enters into the bloodstream, attacks a particular kind of cell known as the T4, the T cell, which is instrumental in the white blood cells in filtering out viruses in your immune system. It attacks these, depletes these, and this leaves the body vulnerable to viruses that enter in. And then the whole question of how is AIDS transmitted? Essentially, the more compact answer is AIDS is transmitted through any exchange of bodily fluids. And this includes blood, semen. People aren't as sure whether it can be transmitted through saliva. It's possible, theoretically possible, they don't know. But it essentially occurs through exchange of semen, blood, or other body fluids, one, during intimate sexual contact. Secondly, it's been known to occur through sharing of contaminated needles, particularly by IV drug abusers, and also rarely through blood transfusions, particularly before blood was being screened for AIDS viruses. AIDS has also been known to be transmitted from a mother who has AIDS to an unborn child through the womb, the placenta. So your major forms, the vast majority, is intimate sexual contact or sharing of contaminated needles. Also, in some rare cases, through blood transfusion or through from passing from the mother to an infant. The thing that's important to point out, though, is that AIDS is a virus. AIDS is not a gay disease. In this country, it has attacked primarily gay men, but elsewhere around the world, it is found in a wide variety of different groups. And so it is helpful to understand what it is and what it is not. I've listed up here one of the things is homophobia and AIDS, some responses, or what have been some particularly homophobic responses to AIDS, where we see the intersection between homophobia and the AIDS crisis. One of them is particularly from the churches, and that has been the whole labeling of AIDS as divine punishment. God is punishing gay men through this disease, this plague. One, I would say that is a particularly cruel response from the church, but I also think it's highly selective. We don't usually do that against children who come down with leukemia, that God is punishing them, even though there are numbers of children who are vulnerable to that. In the gospel, Jesus was particularly involved in dispelling the idea that leprosy was punishment from God, that illness was punishment from God, and yet this is being resurrected in this case, I think, because of homophobia, as another way of targeting gay men. But there have been responses from the secular community that as well that reveal a lot of homophobia. William F. Buckley, many of you may know of as a conservative writer, his suggestion is that all AIDS, or people who have AIDS, be tattooed so that that's visible to them, much in the way that concentration camp people under Nazi Germany were tattooed. The suggestion of quarantine has come from many people, including Pat Buchanan, the major speechwriter for President Reagan. Also, one of the candidates for governor in Minnesota has suggested quarantining all people suspected of having AIDS. And the person who came in second in the recent mayor's contest in Houston, I forget his name, but he received 40-something percent of the vote. He had a much simpler solution. He said, "We can get rid of AIDS by shooting the queers. Just line up the queers and shoot them." Fortunately, he lost. But these are kinds of responses that are this crisis is generating, and I would submit it's because of homophobia rather than the crisis itself. People are really afraid. There is a whole AIDS hysteria going on that is irrational when you look at the information that's available about AIDS and how it spreads and how it doesn't spread. Another homophobic response to AIDS has been the increasing discrimination against not only AIDS patients, but against all gay people in the area of housing, jobs, and especially in insurance. People who are openly gay now are finding it increasingly difficult to get medical insurance because as insurance companies see the skyrocketing bills around AIDS, they want to protect themselves, and so they're simply denying insurance now to anybody who might be a potential, at some point, AIDS victim. Another area, I think, has been the strong resistance, both in government and within the church, to safe sex education. Since AIDS is primarily passed as a sexual disease, there are areas of what are known as safe sex, which allow people to be sexual that don't transmit the disease. But there's been tremendous resistance to developing educational programs about this because people are afraid of being accused of promoting or supporting homosexuality. And so, for example, last year the federal government approved $160,000 at the national level for AIDS education about AIDS. It's just a scandal. But again, I would say this is because homophobia is denying us a way, creative ways to respond to this disease. Another thing that we see a lot are irrational fears of contagiousness. There are volumes of information about AIDS available and how it's caught and how it's not caught. And yet there is a tremendous fear of AIDS being able to be caught through casual contact. And this comes up in a number of ways, but particularly I think in the fears around our children, the children in the schools. Some of you may have followed the situation of the young boy in Indiana who for over a year now has been denied the right to return to his school because he has AIDS. And the parents, many of the parents are very fearful that if he goes to school there, he will come down with AIDS. Even though the government agencies and private agencies who research AIDS say that's virtually impossible. But there is tremendous fear about that. And this has caused educational systems throughout the country to have to re-examine their guidelines about what they will do, because inevitably many school systems will be faced with this same situation as the AIDS crisis worsens. The effect of homophobia due to AIDS is not only in the non-gay community. It also affects the behavior of gay people very much, and I'll just list a couple of those. One has been that the vast majority of gay men are still closeted. They are not open about being gay. And this has been very, very difficult in trying to break this disease through education, through getting gay men to get tested to find out whether they are carriers of the disease or not. Because the problem in this case is to be medically diagnosed is also to be morally diagnosed. There's a whole stigma that comes along with being diagnosed as AIDS positive, as carrying the virus. And I should mention that there are many more people that carry the virus than have developed AIDS at this point. It's possible to have the virus, to be a carrier of it, without having developed the AIDS syndrome. But the whole stigma of having that has kept many, many people, for fear of being disclosed as homosexual, in their closets. There is a lot of fear about cooperating with government programs such as contact notification. The whole idea that if you are positive with AIDS, you should tell the people that you've had sexual intercourse with so that they can take appropriate steps to see if they are positive with AIDS. And yet there is a lot of fear among the gay community that lists are being compiled about gay people, and those lists have been used in many other instances to discriminate against people, so people, in order to avoid having any compilation of lists, are simply avoiding cooperation with AIDS programs or AIDS prevention programs. Secondly, within the gay community, there's widespread distrust of the medical establishment. And this comes out of our history, that only in very recent years have we not been categorized as ill or sick by the medical community. And there have been a number of ghastly experiments that have been carried out on gay people trying to turn them into non-gay people by the medical establishment. So there's a lot of distrust historically there. What this has done, however, within the gay community is lead to denial patterns. The medical establishment says this about AIDS. Why should I believe them? I'm not going to believe them that I need to do that, and therefore I deny that I need to change my sexual habits or my patterns of living. The whole denial process that sets in. And finally, I think homophobia affects gay people around AIDS, around that internalized homophobia, which has been the self-hatred, the feeling of, well, I'm a lousy person anyway, I'm probably going to get AIDS anyway, so why bother worrying about it? I'm just going to live and have a good time in the meantime. You see that kind of self-hatred in parts of the gay community as a reaction to AIDS. The last thing I mentioned was simply the response of the church, and I listed a couple of things, one to homophobia and one to AIDS. And these are, again, my recommendations based on my own experience, and I would like to open it up for discussion after that. But as far as the church, I think one of the most important things that the church needs to be about is just plain education. We need to have accurate information about who gay people are. And I think we need to have positive gay role models to break the stereotypes that are so dominant in our society. I think the church has to be upfront on its attack on sexism and heterosexism and the way that boxes all of us, whether we're straight or gay, and represses all of us. It's been shown that people who are comfortable with equality and people who are comfortable with their own sexuality are much less homophobic, much less apt to repress gay people. And I think the church can play a large role in re-educating us to be comfortable with who we are created to be as sexual beings and granting equality to all. I think we need to see increased serious theological reflection on sexuality and on homosexuality and have that be part of the discussion within our churches. Bring the topic of sexuality out of the closet so that we can talk about it. And I think the church needs to see that working for gay rights is part of the larger struggle for human rights around the world. The whole notion that until we're all free, none of us are free. As far as AIDS, a number of these are very similar. One of the things I think the church needs to do is recognize its own share of responsibility in the AIDS crisis. The church did not cause AIDS, but the church has been responsible in creating the conditions where a minority of people have felt that they have had to live secretly, clandestinely, and not up front, and that has been the climate that has brought about much of the AIDS crisis. And the church needs to deal with that. The church has to understand that it has been the major institutional legitimizer of what has been called compulsory heterosexuality. Not heterosexual by choice, but heterosexual by compulsion. And the church has legitimized that. There needs to be a lot of education about sexuality, homosexuality, and AIDS, and the church needs to come to grips with its own homophobia, just as gay people need to come to grips with their own homophobia. The church needs to develop sensitive pastoral responses to AIDS that would include care of victims of AIDS, counseling and pastoral care of people involved in that, whether it's family members, whether it's victims of AIDS, whether it's medical people who constantly see their patients dying one after another in spite of all of their good helps. We need to be there to be pastoral agents in the midst of what is increasingly a very destructive disease. And the church needs to begin to prepare now for a rapidly growing crisis, because unfortunately we've just seen the tip of the iceberg. It's estimated that in another 6 years, if AIDS continues going at the rate it is, there may be as many as 1 million cases. And understand that each AIDS case up to this point has been terminal beyond, say, 2 or 3 years. So we're talking about a devastating, devastating impact. And unless we begin to prepare now, we're not going to have the resources we need to respond to that. Those are some of my thoughts. Appreciate any input or questions that people might have.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Does the medical community know why it's only striking gay men in America?
It's because medical community does not know where AIDS started. And that is, there's a controversy. Some people think it started in Africa. Some people say Haiti. Some people say the United States. It began to appear in roughly similar times, was diagnosed only in 1981. As far as why it is, it's because of the way that it's transmitted, that it attacks certain populations. And it is transmitted sexually, and the gay male community, particularly the sexually active gay male community, is an internal community. They have, the gay men in that community have sex with each other, and so it's easy for that to be passed around that community. It won't get out so easily into the heterosexual community because they're not in, they don't overlap much. The difference is where there are bisexual men who then pass it on to women or other partners, and then it can get out in the heterosexual community. That's also the reason why IV drug abusers have had a high incidence of AIDS as well, because it is passed through contaminated needles because of the blood. And that's also is a community that shares a lot within itself and doesn't have much intersection with the broader community. Those have been the main carriers in this society. Now, in Africa, it's primarily among heterosexual people. But the thing is, it gets into a segment of society, and if that society is sexually active with multiple partners or other means of transmitting bodily fluids, then it will infect that sector. And so there is concern that AIDS may jump out of its early target populations and, for example, get into the heterosexually active population, at which point it would be much more difficult in many ways to isolate. But that seems to be the reason that in this country it has, we don't know why it first appeared in there. There's speculation. It appeared in Haiti. Haiti for many years has been a vacation spot for gay men. It's quite possible that some gay men went to Haiti, contracted it there, and brought it back. But that's all speculation.
I was curious to know if it might have been a different kind of virus within a virus.
It seems to be, I think it's more has to, the reason it's localized in certain populations is the way it's transmitted, rather than it affects certain people who may be genetically different, for example. Mary.
If you told your partner that you had AIDS and they were tested and found to be a carrier of the AIDS virus, except for using safe sex, what would they do? I mean, is there anything, if you're a carrier, why is it so important to have people screened and tested?
The most important thing is to try and contain the disease, I think, to one, practice responsible sexual behavior so that you're not passing it along to people unknowingly. And so it is, I think, a lot to change one's own sexual behavior in that way and have it be responsible. As far as this point, there is no AIDS vaccine that's been developed, so there's no way of preventing getting it. There is no known cure for AIDS, so there's no way of curing a person once they get it. What happens is that people pick up the virus and then somewhere in the next 5 to 10 years probably will develop AIDS itself or what's been called AIDS-related complex, which is a different set of opportunistic infections and diseases. But there are many, many people who are AIDS carriers who are totally healthy at this point. They haven't developed AIDS itself. But they need to be aware that they have the potential of passing that along to someone. And so it's not anything that can be done once you get it. But you can change your sexual behavior so that any kind of sexual intimacy doesn't involve exchange of bodily fluids, for example.
One, I think we all need to realize and remember that the general population is all susceptible, or we all are at risk of AIDS because, as you mentioned, with blood transfusion and as with surgery, those are all possible risk people. Also, the medical personnel, too, are at great risk. I just heard of a person who accidentally stuck herself after treating the AIDS patient, and so we're all at risk. And also, I understand, and I too am afraid of AIDS because it is a virus, it's difficult to treat, and there isn't a cure for virus, it's the worst thing to treat.
Yeah, I think you're right. There are a couple things I would say in response. I think it's important to realize that AIDS has the potential of striking anybody, and so we need to take it seriously. But I think we also need to understand how AIDS as a virus reacts so that we don't add to the AIDS hysteria. And that's one of the things I think is very helpful about this thing. It just talks about some facts about transmission. AIDS is not passed through casual contact. And
it
so
is
we,
passed through blood.
It is passed through blood, but there is also now blood has been screened now for the last several years, and of people who have developed AIDS from blood transfusion, as far as I know, they have all been people who had received blood before the AIDS screening took place. All of the nation's blood supply now is passing through screening, which eliminates blood that has the AIDS virus in it. And so there has been a vast effort to protect the nation's blood supply because that's one of the primary fears that took place. As far as hospital workers, fortunately, there's a lot more education going on for hospital workers to understand how AIDS is and is not transmitted so that care can be taken, such as in any communicable disease such as hepatitis or other diseases where you need to be careful when you're dealing with them. But there are, it's the difference between being careful and taking caution to excluding healthcare to people who have AIDS. And I think, just put it this way, if AIDS were the exact same thing but only struck 10-year-old girls instead of gay men, I think there'd be a lot less outcry about denying health care to 10-year-old girls than there would be to gay men. The element that's the difference there is the homophobia. You'd have the exact same risk of treating girls, 10-year-old girls who had AIDS, as you would to gay men, but the difference is our homophobia says it is okay. The gay people brought it upon themselves, therefore we can allow them to deal with it by themselves. Question back here, Bill.
I wanted to share a response in our parish where there was a statement published that there was, of course, the possibility that there may be people within the church who had AIDS, and therefore in using the common cup, they asked that anyone who had any possibility of having any infection please use intention so that we wouldn't be putting our fellow members who might have AIDS at the grave risk of catching something from us, which could have such devastating consequences for them.
And that brings up another fear. There's a lot of fear on the other side about using a common cup, that people might be able to catch AIDS from using the common cup because of saliva of someone who had AIDS shared from the cup. There have been a number of studies on that. They have isolated the AIDS virus very rarely in saliva. So they can see that it is in saliva, but there has been no evidence and no success in having that AIDS virus survive at all on a cup or outside so that it would be transmittable. So that the Center for Disease Control says that the chances are negligible of picking it up that way. But it is important to know these are the issues that we need to deal with as a church so that we know how to respond in prudent but compassionate ways. I think there was a question over here somewhere.
That was my question.
Okay. Let me...
How is AIDS detected? By blood test?
There is a, what happens is the blood test that detects AIDS detects the antibodies that the body puts out when the AIDS virus attacks. And this is typical, I guess, of the way blood tests oftentimes happen through viruses, that when a virus attacks the body will begin to develop antibodies, and you can test the blood for the presence of those antibodies. And so that's what the virus does now. It does not detect does not detect whether AIDS is present. It detects whether the virus is present or not in the blood. So it's the combination of looking at whether the virus is present in the blood and any of those opportunistic diseases are present, such as the Kaposi's sarcoma that we mentioned, or the pneumonia. If those are present and the virus is present, that's taken as a diagnosis the person probably has AIDS.
As a part of the annual physical exam that I take, my physician sends to, I think it's Kansas City, a blood sample, which they check cholesterol level and all of that. Can they, and do they also, as a matter of procedure, test AIDS?
I don't think as a matter of procedure they do. There are special clinics where you can have that done, or you could request to have it done, but as far as I know, I don't know of any places where that's being done as a matter of procedure.
Why couldn't they make it as a matter of policy that all, and I don't know the technology involved of that, but could they make as a matter of policy just test that?
I don't know enough about the expense and the difficulty of doing it. That might be a factor there. But I think the other factor is a real fear level. There is a real fear that if people know that their blood is going to be tested for AIDS, that will keep people from having their blood tested. That's one of the real problems within the gay community. People are not going in to have their blood tested because if it comes up positive, some states require that be reported to the state, and therefore their names come out in public. And I think what's going to be especially devastating about this impact of this crisis in the next 5 years is you're going to have a lot of people like Brock Hudson, who were people who have respectable positions in society and so forth, who because they come down with AIDS are going to also be forced out of the closet. And this will devastate careers, marriages. There are many, many gay men who are involved in heterosexual marriage. And the fear is among so many people that if they know their blood is going to be tested for that and it might be positive, they won't have it tested.
But I would have to ask my physician.
I believe so, yeah. There was a question up here, Mary.
I just wanted to share a comment on how you feel or how you think gay men feel in general with this crisis. And what does it do to the way you relate to other men or your sexuality? I was trying to think if there was a disease that was incurable in the heterosexual community. Would you ever engage in sex if you thought you probably would die or might?
Yeah, the question, I don't know if people heard, but for how do I respond as a gay person, or how do people in the gay community respond to AIDS, and what, how does it make us feel? What is it like to have to be faced with this crisis? There are many, many different responses, I think. One, it has affected the sexual behavior of many parts of the gay community. There is much less multiple sexual partners going on, a much more interest in long-term monogamous relationships. There has been some impact in safe sex and people now, for example, using condoms, which previously was pretty marketable to the heterosexual community because it was used to prevent birth taking place, conception. But there, I've seen a lot more, there's obviously a lot of fear. that has taken place, and there have been some creative responses to that fear and some destructive responses. The whole aspects of denial are very much present, and you see people who just refuse to change their patterns. But I think one of the most positive or creative responses is the way it has brought many, many sectors of the gay community together, because we realize we're fighting for our lives, and not only our lives due to AIDS, but our lives to just exist in this society, because there is a tremendous amount of anti-gay sentiment brewing because of the AIDS crisis, and a real fear that we will be tattooed, put in concentration camps, shot. Those are the extremes, but the less extremes ones are denied housing, denied jobs, those kinds. So there's a lot of fear, there's been a lot of organizing, particularly since much of the broader community has refused to respond to the AIDS crisis in caring ways. The gay community has set up a lot of counseling services. There's a whole buddy system into place where an AIDS patient who is diagnosed with AIDS is oftentimes assigned three or four other people who simply are a buddy to him and to stay with him, do his shopping, especially as he gets weaker due to the disease. There's counseling services set up to deal with parents and family members who may not have known the person was gay before. So there has been, one of the things that has been very helpful is it has galvanized the gay community and gotten past a lot of the infighting into developing into a caring, responsive community. On the individual level, I know there are a lot of more conversations going on. Casual sex is much on the decrease in many areas. Gay men talk to each other now before and talk about AIDS and talk about their relationship. So there have been some changes in that area. Is that the kind of thing you're asking for?
Okay.
I really wonder sometimes if the heterosexual community doesn't have more responsibility for AIDS than it's willing to acknowledge. And this, it's hard for me to say this because this is a radical viewpoint, but I know in my own body I get sick when I have pressed a part of myself or pushed down a part of myself or deny it. And I often wonder if, because society oppresses gay people, if society as a whole isn't sick and the sickness is just, you know, being projected or showing up in one aspect of it.
Well, there are some ways that I think, and this is not to make people feel guilty, but I think there are ways that the society in general and the church in particular do share some responsibility. People oftentimes ask me, well, why do gay people go to bars to meet other people? And I say, have you ever tried to meet someone gay at a church social? You know, we just have been denied access to normal outlets for relationships. The response, one time there was a university that allowed some lesbian and gay dances on their campus, and there was such an outcry over that they cut them off. And the response of the lesbian and gay members on campus are, do you realize that you're forcing us back to the bars? You've just denied us our one non-sexual oriented way of meeting other lesbians and gay people. That has been the difficulty, because we've been an oppressed community that has had to hide. We've had to find other outlets, and until recently that's been almost exclusively around the bar scene, which is sexual. So there's been a whole sexual ethic developed around that, and then since AIDS is transmitted sexually, it's got involved in that. So thank you very much for your participation. Again, I would mention to people, feel free to take one of the flyers here on the AIDS Challenge.